This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com. Welcome to The Testing Show. I'm Michael Larson, your show producer, and today we are joined by Percy Ababa.
Good morning, everyone.
Justin Rohrman.
Good morning.
Our special guest, Jared Small.
Hi.
And, of course, our ringmaster and leader, Matt Heuser. Take it away, Matt.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you. Good to have everybody here. For those who don't know Jared Small, I met Jared at QA or the Highway 2 or 3 years ago. Jared's the test manager at BlackBerry and has quietly been doing excellent work up in Canada for 10, 15 years doing software testing while the company grew from a couple hundred employees to tens of thousands. So tell us a little bit about Jared.
Hi, thanks, Matt. It's great to be here with you today. My role, as you mentioned, is a test manager with BlackBerry. Been there for almost 10 years now. Haven't been a test manager for that long. I've been a team lead there for the last 6 or 7 years and recently became a test manager. Obviously, mobile testing is kind of my area. I test on the software level on the device itself, so less into the software, into mobile device management, but more onto the on-device experience for end users. And part of the Kitchener-Waterloo Software Quality Association, I'm on the board there as well. We host a yearly conference targeting quality, which you may have heard of, and we try to be as involved in the testing community as possible, reaching out to local conferences like QA of the Highway and trying to be involved in the community in podcasts like this today. So very happy to be here.
Thanks, Jared. Super excited that you could be here. This year at QA or the Highway, we did a panel on making QA strategic and how QA can communicate its value, how we can add more value, how we can have a seat at the strategy table. It kind of ties into the trusted advisory work that we've done on this podcast a few episodes back, but it's also about defining and communicating the value of test strategically. I want to talk about that today. Before we do that, though, I want to sort of open the news bag for what's going on in the industry. And I think I should start with this little Twitter, kerfluffle over the weekend where Martin Burns was talking about the differences between no estimates and Scrum. And he said that teams that did Scrum had 250% higher quality. I don't know if Jared caught that. I'm kind of curious. If you heard that in a meeting, what do you think that means?
Sorry, I missed the conversation that Martin was having.
Exactly. That's why I'm doing it on purpose. So you're in a meeting and someone throws that out. How do you respond? Like, what does that even mean? What do you think it means?
It's inconceivable to make blanket statements like that for starters. I mean, unless you'd like to cause controversy. I'm not sure what Martin's objective is. If he's on social media, you may be wanting to engage in a conversation. But certainly to say that there's a one-size-fits-all for any methodology to indicate that there's a percentage like that, it's a risky road to go down for sure. So it seems like to me he's obviously wanting to initiate a conversation, but do I agree with that? No, definitely not.
So it turns out he linked to a survey by Rally that we're going to put in the show notes. I guess it's not a survey. They studied their own data, and they found that these teams that were doing Scrum, which was basically using all the Rally features and the tools, including story points, pointing, and breaking into tasks, they had significantly lower bugs reported in production per person day of the project. So for a team of 10 people, for a project that's a year long, you have 2,200 person days, and then they divided the number of bugs by the number of person days, and they found that Scrum had significantly lower. My first thought on strategy, obviously, is if we don't provide information to decision makers, someone else will, and we might not like what they have to say. But I should let you guys do a little bit of analysis first. So thoughts on that?
My first reaction when I saw the quote that you could improve quality by 250% was just, oh my gosh, this is just plain dumb. Who would make that claim? So ignoring the measurement side of it, you have to ask the question, how are they defining these teams? What is a scrum team? What is a no measurements team? And how are they actually working? A lot of the time on scrum teams, you'll see people not even document bugs. The definition of quality on this white paper was bugs found downstream. So if people aren't documenting bugs, customers aren't submitting bugs, maybe stuff gets passed over email and just fixed. What are you actually measuring? Half of your measurement of quality is just being swept under the rug, you know?
I think I kind of like this comment, so I'm borrowing a bit from Justin's answer to this about the idea of downstream bugs being a quality measure. I think your key point here, though, is the point that measurements are used to construct a reality for people that were not there to observe it. Whose reality are you constructing? I think that's very instructive.
Wait, didn't Leonardo DiCaprio say that in Inception?
Probably.
But no, that's that was from a man with a very unfortunate name, Edward Boring. He wrote a very dense textbook on the history of experimental psychology. And it just so happens there's a lot of failings that they went through about measurement that I've used to learn about how software testers measure stuff.
I do want to do a podcast on measurement. I think that's going to be valuable. For now, I think we can all, like, this is kind of a silly claim. But it's taken seriously by people who are looking for answers. So what kind of better answers can testing provide? And that's what I want to talk about during the strategy part of the show. The other thing I wanted to mention before we get on to strategy is this whole Donald Trump invasion. It seems almost like the British invasion with the Beatles. Like, came out of nowhere, super popular. And there's a lot of reasons for that. This is not a political show. There's a lot of reasons for that. People are disappointed with the establishment. They want a political outsider. It doesn't matter. Scott Adams has been doing some commentary on Trump. And specifically, Donald Trump is using classic persuasion tactics where he finds an emotional trigger and then he tells people, it's not your fault. Other people have inflicted it on you. They are your enemies. I'm on your side. And then he says, it's okay to be able to say these people are your enemies. So he's doing this empathy building where he's basically telling people that I'm one of you. And the political issues melt away as we just sort of greet him as this person who's one of us against the other guy. I think to some extent that actually is happening. Whether you agree or disagree with him on the issues, he's effective at persuasion. So first question, am I wrong at that?
I don't think you're wrong at that, Matt. I think it was Aristotle that coined the three artistic proofs in persuasion, which is logos, pathos, and ethos. And I think from the pathos perspective, where you're appealing with the person's emotions, I think that's where he's really good. I don't agree with his ethical appeal, which is the ethos, and as well as the logos side of things. And I think the way he presents things from raw logic and reasoning, it is a very shallow agreement that you can easily push over his logic with a proverbial finger. That's really where, I mean, if it's a three-legged bench, it's only one leg that's standing. That's what he's really standing on. And that's what really is the problem that I have with his platform.
One of the things I did find interesting was just a message that somebody had posted on a board a while back. This was directed primarily to the Republican establishment. It said, rather than being nervous or anxious about how you are going to defeat Trump, perhaps the bigger question should be, how has the leadership so failed its constituents that Trump is seen as a viable option? What is it that makes it so that so many people are inspired by rhetoric and by this emotional appeal? Are we so intimidated? Are we so anxious about our future? And I'm using a collective we future here, that this appeals to a broad number of people. And the real question is, how real is this broad appeal? And I know this is not a political podcast. That's why I'm going to shut up about this right now.
I think there's a direct tie back into testing. I think that Perzay nailed it in that you have this logos, pathos, and ethos. And historically, testers are pretty darn bad at connecting at the emotional pathos level. I mean, we're really bad at it. We come in the room and we say, you're screwing up, it's all crappy, it's terrible, and you did a crappy job, I hate you. We don't actually say, I hate you. But what the other person hears is, I hate you. And now you've created a situation where, in order for them to feel a sense of self-worth and respect and feel good about themselves, we have to be wrong. And then we're surprised when they get overruled. Exaggerating for effect. But for some testers, that interaction is literally true, and for others, it's just not quite that bad. Understanding how emotions impact decisions, shouldn't that be part of our job? And why are we so bad at it? Or maybe I'm wrong.
I think it's a massive part. If I can lean on the classes that I've taught for AST for a long time and BBST class series, we have a class called Bug Advocacy. What that basically is rhetoric for testers.
Justin, you just reminded me of the RIMGEA mnemonic, which is what we teach in that class as part of the 6 approaches to bug reporting. The funny thing is the first 5 connects directly to fear because you're not just replicating it, you're trying to isolate it, you're maximizing it, you're generalizing it, you're externalizing it. And then the 6th one, which is the A part, says, and you say it clearly and dispassionately, which kind of tones the things down. But I must agree, fear is there, but I don't think we as testers use that primarily. We are actually using logic and even defining the culture of why will this particular issue show up. But then we have to be very clear, how will this actually affect the value of the product that we're delivering?
That's fantastic. I did not know that mnemonic. One more piece of news. Folks at QualiTest have a couple articles up. We'll link to them. One is on how to test a laser gun. In our classes, we try to cover this kind of high-level strategy on physical objects, and it's a pretty good example. The other one is this idea of quantifying the cost of technical debt. The example they use is the dollar cost to fix bugs, and saying, if we continue to defer these bugs and not fix them, these are the costs that we are incurring. There's a strategy table somewhere where people are planning the next project, and testing isn't there. What can we do to explain our value more clearly, to get in the room? And if you were in the room, what would you say?
I've been trying to discuss this with my team in a bunch of different ways, is the whole idea of shifting testing leftward, getting testing involved earlier in the process, making it so that it's not this back and forth, trying to convince an organization that you're doing something and getting buy-in up front on it is very difficult. Even with smaller teams, it can be difficult because you have to get everybody on the same page. My best approach is dealing with individual programmers one-on-one. We have this current set of stories that we're working on that are all tied together. I just sat down with this one programmer and suggested that maybe a better approach would be both of us to just sit down and do some back and forth. Show me your concept. Show me some of the things you want to be working on. And let me ask questions before we even get to the point of doing the kickoff. This particular program was, I'm all for it. We sat down, we started working through some of the examples, and we realized we found holes just in that 20-minute discussion. It would have taken us 5 to 6 times longer. So there was that one chance to persuade and show that by having this discussion in a way that might not be natural or normal, we were able to save a considerable amount of time, and I would say affect the overall quality of those features significantly.
I think it's interesting that you say that type of discussion may not be natural. There have been phases, I like to think of it, in the way we've shaped software development teams over time. Back in the day of Jerry Weinberg, when he was actively programming and writing production code, there were no pieces of a team. There were programmers and they tested each other's code. They were officially shifted left. They were looking at the requirements, testing, programming, all within the same cycle. Now, at some point during the 70s or 80s, the groups got split apart. Testing became testing, development became development, and they started happening at different points in time. So it became controversial for the two to mix and for testers to sit with development and pair test. And I think it did a really big disservice to the industry as a whole.
I think you're talking about Bill Hetzel, 1973, and the Chapel Hill Conference.
Well, that's the one.
The book that came out of that was Program Test Methods. So Weinberg, 58, Project Mercury, he has the first independent test team, first known documented. It was a time-sharing system. I think they were using punch cards, and the only way to test it was to write code. So their testers were senior programmer dudes, to the extent that such a thing existed, because there were no CS programs. It was in 73 that the outcome of that was testing should be a simple, straightforward, predictable, repeatable business process that anybody can do if we just define everything up front and sort of run all the things. And then test automation is taking all of the things that we have just written down and then having the computer do exactly the same thing. After that, you still see Jerry Weinberg and James Bach saying, hey, you know, we don't have to do it that way. We could be humans. And the voice of modernism was just much louder than them for the next 20 years or so. But I don't think we have to do it that way.
I think that what we're seeing is the convergence back to testers becoming a greater part of the team. And I think Agile and Scrum are helping to facilitate that in general. If testers see themselves as part of the team, then they'll be more apt to be involved in other activities that are going on within an Agile team or within any project team. We need to stop defining ourselves simply as testers, and we need to expand and grow beyond that.
What do you mean by that? Stop defining ourselves as testers?
As testers only is what I should say. I do define myself as a tester in almost every conversation I have about my career. But certainly going beyond just the role of critiquing software and providing input on defects or bugs in the system, we have a much greater role to play beyond that. That's what we're talking about today as well. We can insert ourselves into the greater process of software development. I think developers can be surprised sometimes by our inputs and by volunteering to do simple things like running project meetings, understanding the code that you're testing and things like that as well. So definitely add more to the process overall and become more strategic.
Let's get specific about strategic. I'm interested in getting in the room for the strategy discussions. When I was a project manager, I would frequently have these conversations about shifting left. And the developers would say, we need to be in the room when senior management makes their decisions. And I would say, you don't want to be in that room. I'm in that room. And they're throwing darts to create the pile of jello with deadlines attached that they throw to you. You're complaining this stuff is a mess now. If you were involved earlier, you would see that it is even messier. You don't want to be there. And often testers feel the same way. The project is inflicted on them and they're involved later. But let's say we get earlier than the story. We get in the room when they're having this conversation about what to build, how long it'll take, how much money it'll make. What value can testing add to that conversation?
I think it would be the same value that testing always adds, which is shining a light on the project, exposing things that people didn't already know. Testers have a way of finding out where the project might be late, what bugs customers might care about that aren't being addressed. It's information that people at that higher level might not have access to because they're not dealing with the day-to-day aspects of the project.
I'll give you an example, and you tell me how I should have done it. I was in a meeting 8 years ago as the technical representative. It was an insurance company, and they wanted to move to real-time claims adjudication, which is a really fancy way to say, you swipe my membership card in the health plan, it sends a data file back to the insurance company. It calculates what the adjusted payment amount would be, calculates whether or not I've hit my deductible and my copay, and tells me how much to pay at the counter for my doctor's visit. And then I'm done. It's done. I give my $20, I walk away, and all the paperwork is processed. There's no letter in the mail. There's no billing and collections agency involved. It's all done right there because we could do the claim right there. Instead, what happens at most U.S. insurance agencies is that they electronically submit the claim, and then overnight a batch runs. And then you say, oh, they owe $20. And you send an email or a letter to the doctor, and then with a balance, and the doctor has to then send something to their collections agency, who has to send you a letter in the mail so you can write a check for $20 that they get 2 months later. It's just much better. We're in the meeting, and talking about how it's going to be fantastic and everything's great, and I say, you do know that the claims processing system that we're in the middle of converting to, the whole conversion probably cost around $20 million and probably took 50 to 75% of IT's focus for 4 years to convert to. You do know that that claims processing system only processes claims in batch, right? What do you mean? Well, if you want to process a claim, you have to take customer service offline. That's why we do it overnight, because we don't have customer service run overnight. If you want to process a claim, then you couldn't answer the phone and do a lookup on anyone else because it's trying to do transaction processing. It locks the database up. You can't do a select on it. I didn't quite say it that articulately. And the meeting was abruptly ended. It had three directors in it, maybe a vice president, me and the project manager. And we were meeting weekly to talk about ongoing work. And the next week, and I saved the company a ton of wasted time. They would have talked about this forever until eventually someone asked for an estimate and the answer would have come back, we can't do it. The next day, the project manager came to my desk and said, Matt, you don't need to come to the next meeting. Well, of course I don't. It's great that I'm an optional invitee and I get to decide, I get to come into the meeting. So, no, Matt, we're not sure it's the best use of your time. Slowly it dawned on me, like, you're uninviting me from the meeting? And she said, yep, that's what we're doing. The next week, that group met. She came by my cube and said, senior management has decided not to pursue real-time claims adjudication at this time. And I never went to those meetings anymore. I was trying to be helpful. I thought I was doing my job. So give me some examples of what tests can say that don't get us kicked out.
Well, that does certainly open up a bigger question. If we want to be part of the discussion, we have to be able to discuss it in a way to where we're not the bearers always of bad news. Either they don't see us adding value or we're asking too many questions that stall what people really want to do.
Yeah, totally we do that.
And
yeah,
I don't know that there is really a good answer there, short of if somebody really wants to do something and we're seen as the killjoy to make sure that their pet project doesn't get done, then I don't know that we necessarily do provide a value there other than to say we might be saving the organization a lot of time and wasted energy because we're pointing out the obvious details that they don't want to consider. And it's just like when somebody says, hey, we've got a new tool we want to put into place, and somebody then has to bring up, have you really considered all the ramifications of what putting that tool in place means?
Gives me a good reminder of something Jared said just a little bit ago, extending a little bit past the role of a tester. In my personal view, the role of a tester is to explore and report discoveries that are important to the customers. In this meeting, that's exactly what you were doing. You found a problem and you said, hey, this isn't going to work and it's going to cost the company lots of money because we're going to spend time working on it. It's just not going to happen. So if you extend that role a little bit, you could have added a but to the end and some other potentials that might work. Like, but we can do this. Adding potential alternatives, speaking to the financial aspects of the business, would move that conversation a little bit further than dropping bombs about how this will never work and we're just going to fail.
That's a great point. Same company, I was in a meeting where they were inflicting process on us. How could we possibly make this ridiculous deadline? And I said, if you can get me out of the process, the template, and the document, I can hit your deadline. And people were like, is it going to work? What's my track record? Would I say that if I couldn't? I don't think I was quite that brazen. It was a long time ago. But we were allowed an exception. The vice president of IS sent an email saying, this project is accepted from our standard practice, which no one had ever done before. We had no idea if it would work, but it had become our standard practice the day before yesterday. And I think that I was really providing a lot of good information there.
This is an interesting side conversation, and I actually had this talk a few weeks ago with, of all people, the guitarist in my band, who also happens to be a director of security for a company. That's one of the neat things about being older now is that you can actually be in a rock and roll band and you can have real jobs too. We had this discussion that sometimes we get processes inflicted upon us, and there are different ways that those processes that are inflicted and how we can offer to be of help. Sometimes those opportunities can go into very strange situations. And I was describing some of the ways that I had dealt with these situations in the past. And he started laughing. He says, you know what? You are this classic type. Bless you for being it, but you're going to drive a lot of people crazy. You are what we call the overly compliant guy. Sometimes you're going to find people that are going to subvert processes completely and they're going to be vocal about it. You're going to find people who are going to not subvert the processes outwardly, but they're going to just under the surface, they're going to do what they're going to do. And then there is the person that something's been set up. You're the type of a person who says, okay, here's the strategy that we've put into place. This is what we're going to use. I'm going to follow it. to the point that I'm going to demonstrate to you how ridiculous it is that you've put us in this situation. And Matt, your whole, yeah, we're not going to have you in the room anymore because you're pointing out the most basic of tenets. You're being overly compliant. And by being overly compliant, you're showing them how obnoxious and how odious the tasks are that they're asking you to do. The problem is that it doesn't make friends because they look like idiots because we've basically put up front every bad thing that they've done, but we're doing it in a way that highlights the idiocy for everybody.
You know, that actually reminds me. I have a friend who's a behavioral psychologist, and he was brought in because help desk is screwing up and help desk is terrible. It's a big company, a bunch of idiots and all this kind of stuff. And he went to two of the vice presidents and he said, can you sit down with me and the help desk for just half a day and watch what they do? Let's look at the system they are put into and the tasks that we ask them to do and observe it. And of course, they got down there and saw that there was 50 different categories, and each category has 50 different cues, and many of the cues are literally redundant or not watched. So when they take the call, they can't figure out who to route it to, and then the person doesn't get it. And the person that calls doesn't get service, and they have to call back, and they have to find the ticket, and they have to reroute it, or it's routed to the wrong place. The software is so painful. The user interface is so bad. You can't do your job. It's not that the help desk people are unintelligent and we're hiring the wrong quality of people. It's the system that they're put into. But the executives never knew that until they actually sat down and saw the work.
The funny thing is, so Matt was invited to a meeting because they thought he was a project manager. And then when Matt started talking, he started talking as if he's a tester. Then he got kicked out. It seems pretty interesting to me that when you look at specific mindsets where it's a question really of who are we talking to and what is it that they want to hear and is it the right time to tell them what they're thinking about might be problematic as a solution. The tricky thing when you're now part of a strategic review or an architectural review, for example, where you have to take a look and understand why did they even think that this might work in the first place? We think this is cool and awesome, someone else did it, or is there actually a reason behind that? For me right now, my main context is we're trying to apply as best as we can how to turn around a waterfall organization into an agile organization. The challenge really for me for testers is not just shifting left because there's so much more that we can provide an impact for, like conversations on automation, test data management, and continuous delivery. I think you won't achieve that by just shifting left. I call this the Konami approach to software testing, but we need to shift up, up, down, down, left, left, right, right, select, start, BA type of approach. But that requires a lot of skill, which ties back to what we were talking about in the beginning, Matt, where the expectation of testers nowadays is just an operational state. And as testers, we are so much more beyond that. My encouragement to organizations or test managers who are trying to look at how can we better at our testing practice is really to look at where else can we contribute aside from what we're doing now, or at least looking into our internal processes and how to be better at what we do.
I am just going to have to, at this point in time, interject and give a high five to Percy for throwing in the Konami code. 30 lives in Contra. High five, Percy. Thank you for that.
And I think that it feels like we just barely scratched the surface. We're just starting to get going. We want to respect the audience's time. I want to respect the show members' time. I should probably cut it here, but it seems like we've got a lot of work to do. So thanks for taking this journey with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.